May it please the Court, Kate Aronson, representing appellant Adam Norcross with co-counsel Joseph Gabay. Good afternoon. In Swan v. State, this Court began with the prejudice prong, quoting Strickland, "It is if it is easier to dispose of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim on the ground of lack of prejudice, that course should be followed. A careful prejudice inquiry requires the Court to consider all of the relevant evidence that the advisory jury and judge would have had if counsel had taken a different path. That evidence includes the evidence that was admitted in the penalty phase as well as that which was presented in the post-conviction proceeding. Review by this Court is de novo. The Court must reconstruct the record, assess all of the penalty phase or mitigation evidence that could have been presented in addition to that which was presented, and reweigh the totality of the mitigating evidence. So the analysis begins by recounting the aggravating circumstances with respect to Mr. Norcross's case. It was a felony murder statutory aggravator. Setting aside the facts and circumstances of the crime and the victim impact, there were only two non-statutory aggravators that were specific to Adam Norcross. One was his admitted and unapologetic criminality. He got an adrenaline rush, said the trial judge, from breaking and entering, and he brags about his criminal acts. The second non-statutory aggravator found by the trial judge is that he was predisposed to violence. That was in large part based on some girlfriends who testified that he had threats and or minor acts of violence during domestic disputes. On the flip side, there were four mitigators that were actually found by the trial judge. One, he was generally remorseful, his poor upbringing, positive character traits, and he was always gainfully employed. In Porter, the Supreme Court held, had the judge and jury been able to place Porter's life history on the mitigating side of the scale and appropriately reduce the ballast on the aggravating side of the scale, there's clearly a reasonable probability that the advisory jury would have struck a different balance. It's the uninvestigated and unpresented mitigation evidence in this case that not only would have placed Norcross's life history on the mitigating side, but would have, more importantly, substantially and significantly reduced the ballast on the aggravating side. Starting with the non-statutory aggravator of predisposition to violence.
Now, the trial judge on remand found that, the court finds that presentation of the evidence admitted by trial counsel would not have affected the ultimate result, unquote. So why is that wrong?
It has to be a panoramic view of all of the aspects in which the penalty phase presentation would have been different if that evidence had been presented. So it is not the specific trial judge's view of whether it would have changed his or her mind. It is a question of whether all of that evidence presented would have changed the complexion of the penalty phase, how it would have changed it, and it's an objective standard.
I understand that, but is it your position that the trial judge did not answer that inquiry? Because that quote I just gave you suggests that he did.
I suggest that he did answer it, but it's too narrow of a view based on the Supreme Court cases and Third Circuit cases, which this court cited in the remand for analysis. So if you start with predisposition to violence as a non-statutory aggravator, and you look at the uninvestigated and unpresented mitigation evidence that would have reduced the ballast of that aggravating evidence, you're left with adaptation or adjustment to prison. They had an expert who was willing, ready, and able to testify at the penalty hearing that Adam Norcross would adjust well to the structured environment in prison. That expert did not testify. There were no risk factors in Adam Norcross's DOC records or psychological profile that indicated future violence in prison. Mr. Aiken, a prison warden of over 30 years, testified to that in the penalty phase. This is an individual who, as a child, witnessed domestic violence. He was abused as a kid. No expert testified regarding child development and personality development and the effect that witnessing domestic violence and being abused as a kid has on an individual's ability to relate later in life, including his behavior or reaction when in a domestic argument or dispute with a girlfriend. The last piece to rebut that non-statutory aggravator of predisposition to violence is the co-defendant, Swan, was without question a father figure to Adam Norcross. He influenced Adam Norcross. Swan, who is influencing Adam Norcross, is a violent man with a criminal history that includes a bank robbery wherein hostages are held at gunpoint. He is an individual Norcross feared. None of that mitigation was presented to reduce the ballast of the aggravating evidence presented by the state. The uninvestigated and unpresented mitigation also would have placed Norcross's life history on the mitigating side of the scale. Unlike Swan, the trial judge accepted Dr. Mack's neuropsychological findings of brain damage and also accepted the diagnoses of cognitive disorder, PTSD, ADHD, dissociative disorder, chronic OCD, including kleptomania and severe anxiety. The state did not offer an expert in the post-conviction proceedings for Norcross to refute Dr. Mack's findings. Brain damage, as the Third Circuit and U.S. Supreme Court has said, is profoundly mitigating because it is not the defendant's responsibility. He's not responsible for it. It affects the regulation of emotion and behavior for Adam Norcross. It would have been relevant and admissible mitigating evidence to rebut the non-statutory aggravators argued by the state. With respect to OCD, kleptomania, severe anxiety, those issues related to Norcross's compulsion to steal, history of theft, and it's rooted in his anxiety disorder. Dr. Mensch, who wants to see Norcross again before the penalty phase, is denied access. He's not sent back by trial counsel. He had a preliminary diagnosis of PTSD. Trial counsel conceded in the post-conviction proceedings, oh, if I had known that, I would have offered that in the penalty phase. That diagnosis, after some additional testing, which Dr. Mechanic, pre-trial, recommended, is confirmed by Dr. Mack. So the entire complexion of the penalty phase would have changed. When Mechanic saw Norcross one time to evaluate him for guilt phase defenses, he opined in some emails that went to the PFE in the public defender's office that he had a traumatic childhood, that there are issues to be explored for the penalty phase or for potential mitigation, but I'd have to go back and see him. He's never sent back either, unexplainably. In the post-conviction proceedings, Dr. Mechanic testified, yes, the traumatic childhood would affect self-esteem, self-identity issues. That rebuts the aggravator of bragging about criminal behavior. It was anecdotally presented that Adam Norcross exaggerated those issues, and there was an explanation as to why. So if trial counsel had met their constitutional duty to investigate and present mitigating evidence, the ballast of the aggravation of two and the only two non-statutory aggravators specific to Adam Norcross would have been significantly reduced. What makes this case egregious is the trial counsel listed Norcross's psychological problems as a mitigator and presented no evidence because they failed to fully investigate it. They also listed lack of propensity for future violence, and offered no expert testimony or other evidence. Adaptability to structured environment was listed by trial counsel, and they offered nothing. No expert evidence was presented on the three critical mitigators designated by trial counsel. And when you take what is a substantially incomplete penalty phase presentation, and you couple that with the inflammatory and prejudicial penalty phase evidence and the improper arguments made in the penalty phase, Mr. Norcross is entitled to a new penalty phase. Sergeant Gunnery's opinion, a Marine Corps officer, testified and opined that Norcross is a man without a conscience. A Marine Corps officer's moral assessment of the defendant was unduly prejudicial and irrelevant. The prosecutor denigrated Norcross's mitigation by referring to the Jerry Springer Show. There was a comparison between Mr. Warren's good character to Mr. Norcross's bad character, which improperly evoked the jury's sympathy. The argument that mitigating evidence does not excuse or justify the murder was improper. There's never a requirement for an explanatory nexus to the crime. So if you consider, under Williams v. Taylor, all the ways in which the penalty phase would have been different but for counsel's mistakes, Mr. Norcross is entitled to a new penalty phase. The core teachings of the seven primary cases that this court remanded to, or requested the trial court to review and remand, the seven core teachings is that counsel must conduct a thorough mitigation of all reasonably available mitigating evidence. Trial counsel in this case had experts who said there are red flags for neuropsychological testing, and they failed to do it. They violated the standards articulated in each of those seven cases. The Supreme Court has repeatedly reversed courts for failing to consider or unreasonably discounting the mitigating evidence adduced at the post-conviction hearing. And against that backdrop, and viewing the totality of the reasonably available mitigating evidence combined with the prosecutorial misconduct and improper and unduly prejudicial arguments, this court cannot find that Norcross's death sentence is reliable. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. This case was previously argued before your honors in January, and there was a remand to the trial judge, who was also the judge at the post-conviction proceedings. The order was similar to that entered with the co-defendant, Ralph Swan. The trial judge was asked to consider seven specific decisions, five by the U.S. Supreme Court and two by the Third Circuit, and secondly, to analyze whether or not the second prong of Strickland ineffective assistance test, the prejudice prong, was or was not established in this particular instance. The trial judge, who, as I say, was also the judge at the post-conviction proceedings, did that, and he issued his opinion on remand. It's the state's position that there was no abuse of discretion in this particular case in denying post-conviction relief, and that the judge made appropriate determinations on remand. That is, he did consider the seven federal court decisions in this particular case, and he analyzed those in the context of some more recent United States Supreme Court decisions, Cullen versus Penholster and two others, and said that, well, basically these U.S. Supreme Court cases all reiterate the basic rule of Strickland, that is that there's a two-part test, and that's the proper legal standard. That was the proper legal standard that was applied in this particular case, and there was certainly no error of law as to the legal standard that was applied here. The trial judge analyzed those cases in the context of Mr. Norcross's both trial testimony. In this particular case, there was a five-day penalty hearing. Approximately 2 days was devoted to the defense. The defense did call 8 witnesses at the original penalty hearing in 2001. And after that, the trial judge then turned from the legal analysis to deciding the second prejudice prong of Strickland, and he concluded that this additional evidence, even when considered with the penalty hearing evidence that was presented in 2001, did not change the trial judge's determination that a death sentence was appropriate in this case. The jury recommendation in this case was a 10-2 vote in favor of the death penalty, that is that the aggravators outweighed the mitigators in this particular case. The assertion that's been made about the ineffective assistance of counsel at the penalty phase, and that's really what we're talking about here, is whether or not Mr. Norcross should receive a due penalty hearing, concerns 3 general categories. There's an allegation that there were unpresented witnesses at the original 2001 penalty hearing, 4 individuals who did testify at the Rule 61 post-conviction proceeding. The trial judge had the opportunity to hear those 4 witnesses, one of whom is the defendant's mother, Kathleen Norcross. The other three are Ruth Corey, who was the mother of Norcross's oldest child, Katie Corey, who is Mr. Norcross's eldest child, and Faith Smith, who is an aunt of Mr. Norcross. Another aunt, Beverly Scullin, did testify at the original 2001 hearing. The other allegation is that there was certain documentary or record evidence that was not presented at the 2001 penalty hearing, specifically records from a juvenile detention facility in Virginia that was a kind of wilderness camp that Mr. Norcross attended when he was 15 and 16 years of age. And then finally, the assertion that's been addressed this morning about not presenting any expert psychological or psychiatric mental health witnesses at the original penalty hearing. At the Rule 61 hearing, Mr. Norcross had an opportunity to present all of this evidence that he complains should have been presented by his trial counsel. The trial judge had the opportunity to consider this new evidence in conjunction with the original evidence, and he remained convinced that the death penalty was an appropriate sentence in this particular case.
Can we infer from the trial judge's opinion on remand that he considered all of the evidence collectively, not only what was presented at trial and at the first penalty phase, but also what was presented in the Rule 61 hearings, and then reweighed the totality of that evidence and found that the aggravating circumstances still outweighed the mitigating? That he did it as opposed to a piecemeal approach. One of the arguments that the appellant's counsel is raising is that the Superior Court erred when it did not consider the evidence collectively and reweigh the evidence in aggravation against the totality of the available mitigating evidence.
No, I think it's clear. It says the asterisk number 3 on the Westlaw report, trial just says it's clear to this court the trial counsel made appropriate professional judgments. That's in reference to what evidence was or was not presented. But the trial judge did have opportunity to hear all that. When you go back to the earlier opinion, the 2010 opinion ruling on the Rule 61 motion where it's denied. The trial judge, in that opinion, the 2010 decision, not the opinion on remand, recounts the new evidence and compares that with the evidence that was presented, and in that context says that there was not an effective assistance of counsel. And on remand, he doesn't reiterate all of that evidence, but if you go back to the 2010 opinion, I think it's certainly a fair inference that the judge is considering all of that evidence together. There was no reason why he would compartmentalize it, and it was all presented for his consideration.
Well, if I understood Justice Ridgely's question correctly, and I concede I may not have, I think his ultimate question is the trial judge may well have compared what's newly offered to what was actually presented, but at the end of the day, either in his post-conviction relief opinion or the opinion on remand, did he then compare that to the evidence offered as aggravating circumstances, weigh the new evidence as if it had been presented, and then conclude, nevertheless, the aggravating circumstances would have outweighed the mitigating, and the death penalty was therefore appropriate? As I understand appellant's argument, it is that you can very neatly compare what's newly offered against even the aggravating circumstances that were presented and see how the mitigating now specifically outweighs particular non-statutory aggravating circumstances. So if you put it all together at the end of the day, in a general way, the whole evidence of mitigation now to a reasonable person would outweigh the whole evidence of aggravating circumstances. Did the trial judge articulate that?
Well, I don't think he says that specifically. A little further down from the sentence I read, the trial judge, and this is the remand opinion 2011, he says, second, the Supreme Court asked, that means the Supreme Court, asked whether the defendant has shown prejudice under Strickland. The court, in its post-trial opinion, and I think that's the 2010 opinion he's talking about there, specifically found no prejudice as to each of the claims on remand. The reasons for these findings are stated in the opinion, and then he cites the footnotes number 20 to the 2010 opinion. So I think you have to look at the two together, but when you do that, I think it's clear that certainly the judge is considering all of that evidence, both what was presented originally and the new evidence, put it all together, reweigh it, and then he goes on and says, to expand on these general findings, the court states that they apply both in the jury recommendation of death, meaning the jury's 10-2 decision, as well as the court's finding that the death penalty was to be imposed. So I think in this, and then he talks about the aggravating evidence. He says that the reasons are stated by the Supreme Court in its affirmance opinion. Then he talks about the aggravating evidence specifically in the remand opinion. So I think if you look at the two of them together, the 2010 opinion where he does detail the mitigation evidence and the 2011 opinion where he repeats what the aggravating evidence is and says that the other mitigating evidence is referred to in the prior opinion, I think a fair reading of that is that he's considering all of that together. It wouldn't make any sense to reference a 2010 opinion if you weren't considering it for some purpose. So I think a fair interpretation is that the trial judge was considering all of that, even though he may not explicitly say that in the 2011 remand opinion. I don't recall him specifically saying that. In this particular case, I don't see that the defense has carried its burden of showing any ineffective assistance of counsel here. Counsel testified at the Rule 61 hearing, explained the reasons why Mrs. Norcross was not called as a witness at trial, the defendant's mother. The court seemed to agree that that was a reasonable strategy. There was also, the court pointed out that while Katie Corey, the defendant's oldest daughter, potentially could have been a witness, she was 12 years old when her father was arrested. She was 13 years old at the time of his trial. And the trial judge did not find that her absence from the penalty hearing substantially affected the the ultimate recommendation by the jury of 10 to 2 or the judge's final imposition of the death sentence. Ruth Corey, the mother of Mr. Norcross's child, she was a problematic witness, much as Kathleen Norcross was. That is, that putting her on the stand entailed some risks. Her testimony at the Rule 61 hearing is not particularly favorable to Mr. Norcross. She basically portrays him as a neglectful father who had very little to do with his daughter. She said that when she and her daughter would visit Kathleen Norcross and Adam Norcross when they moved to Maryland, the Coreys were living in Delaware at the time, they would visit on Sunday afternoons, that Mr. Norcross, Adam Norcross, would have very little association with his daughter, would frequently simply leave the house, and the only time that Ruth Corey could remember him really reaching out to his daughter was on her 11th birthday, that Mr. Norcross did call and ask to spend some time with his daughter on that particular occasion, but otherwise he was basically a neglectful parent. That's not going to be helpful evidence to be presented at a penalty hearing, and the judge rightfully concluded that that certainly was not prejudicial. In fact, having Ruth Corey was going to present more problems than helpful evidence for Mr. Norcross. Faith Smith, she was an aunt. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
That was just a noise from the back there.
I'm sorry. I thought somebody had a question. Faith Smith is Mr. Norcross's aunt. She did not testify at the penalty hearing. Another aunt, Ruth Scullion, did. But even Faith Smith presented some difficulties when she testified at the Rule 61 hearing. She said, well, she had read about Mr. Norcross appearing at Ralph Swan's new trial motion hearing in 2006 and testifying to the effect that Mr. Swan was not involved in this homicide, that it was this other individual named Wayne. And she said, well, she had been visiting Mr. Norcross for some time at prison and had never heard anything about Wayne. And she talked about this person being a fictional character. She also conceded that at times Mr. Norcross does not always tell the truth. So presenting Faith Smith or Ruth Corey or even Kathleen Norris was going to present difficulties had they been presented at the Rule 61 hearing originally in 2001, and the trial judge recognized that. The trial judge also recognized that there was a reasonable investigation here, that the public defender's office employed two individuals, Sherry Gelati and Linda Zervis, that Sherry Gelati was initially involved in collecting records in the case. She collected school records, medical records, military records for Mr. Norcross. So there was a reasonable investigation here, and Sherry Gelati went out on maternity leave shortly before the trial, and Linda Zervis took over. But before Linda Zervis took over, there, Sherry Gelati wrote a very detailed report that was introduced at the Rule 61 hearing describing everything that she had done and pointing out some of the difficulties with her communications with Kathleen Norris, the accused father. And she describes in there the New Dominion school records that have been referred to by the defense in this case. And these concerned records from 1985 and 86. As I said, when Mr. Norcross was 15 and 16 years old, he was placed in this facility in Virginia for thefts. He had stole a pack of gum, and then he had later stolen his mother's car, and I guess she had reported the car theft, and Adam Norcross ended up in this juvenile facility and apparently did fairly well there. The argument was that, well, this should have been presented at the Rule 61 hearing, at the original penalty hearing. The argument was made at the Rule 61 hearing that this should have been presented. But the trial judge found that, well, while that may very well have been helpful to support the argument that he was functioning well in that structured environment, one of the counter arguments to that was the fact that approximately 6 years later, when Mr. Norcross enlisted in the Marine Corps. He was ultimately discharged, I believe, during basic training or shortly after basic training for theft of supplies. And the trial judge observed that, well, the Marine Corps is certainly a structured environment, and he didn't seem to fare very well in the Marine Corps. So there was contrary evidence that could have been presented to rebut that. The expert,
that goes to the prejudice prong rather than the performance deficiency.
Yes, I think that's, you know, whether it was ultimately going to be prejudicial or not. Well, yes, maybe you should have put that in, but if you had, there would have been this counter evidence, and the judge saw those as basically neutralizing one another, that, well, he may have functioned well when he was 15 or 16 at New Dominion, but by the time he's 22 and he's enlisting in the Marine Corps, he's not doing well at all, and he receives a less than honorable discharge from the Marine Corps. So the judge, trial judge, did not find any ultimate prejudice in that context. Finally, as to the expert psychological and psychiatric testimony that was not presented in the original hearing, the trial judge pointed out that Mr. Norcross's attorneys did have him examined prior to trial by both a psychologist and a psychiatrist. He was not found to be suffering from any mental illness. There was no type of psychiatric defense that was going to be available to be offered in the case. There was no indication, I believe, from Dr. Mechanic, the psychiatrist, that he saw any need for any further neurological testing. Dr. Mechanic's expert opinion as a psychiatrist was that Mr. Norcross did not have attention deficit disorder, although Dr. Mack, who testified at the Rule 61 hearing, he's a psychologist, said he thought that Mr. Norcross was suffering from attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, but that was contrary to the diagnosis of Dr. Mechanic. The real difficulty with offering either Dr. Mensch, the psychologist, or Dr. Mechanic, the psychiatrist who examined Mr. Norcross prior to trial, was that both of these individuals had problems with Mr. Norcross's credibility, that he had told a number of different versions of how the homicide occurred. He had made four different incriminatory statements, three to lay people, Mr. Howe, Ms. Roberto, and Bridget Phillips, his former wife, before he was questioned by the police, and made a fourth incriminatory statement. But the statements differed. In two of the statements, I believe to Roberto and the police, Mr. Norcross claims that Mr. Swan was the individual who shot Kenneth Warren, whereas in the other two statements, Mr. Norcross says he was the one who at least was shooting at Warren, if he was not the only person shooting at him. So both Mensch and Dr. Mechanic, according to the trial attorneys, had reservations about Mr. Norcross's credibility. And this was significant because at the penalty hearing for Mr. Norcross, and his penalty hearing is a little different than I've seen in most of these capital cases, Mr. Norcross actually testified at his penalty hearing. He didn't just allocute. He took the witness stand and testified in some detail. And most of the evidence about the childhood abuse when Mr. Norcross was living with his mother's second husband, I believe in the service overseas, comes simply by self-reports from Mr. Norcross. He indicates he was physically and sexually abused by his stepfather. There was no other corroborative evidence of that from his other than his self-report. So self-reports were important, and his credibility was important. It was not going to be helpful at a penalty hearing in 2001 to place an expert psychologist or psychiatrist on the stand to say that, well, they have some problems with his credibility and they're not sure what to believe. That would certainly undermine the self-reports of abuse that was offered solely through Mr. Norcross. So I think that was a wise decision by counsel to forego the testimony of these two individuals. There was also a statement by Dr. Mechanic that he thought the various conflicting versions of how the homicide occurred by Mr. Norcross showed a lack of remorse. and having a medical doctor take the stand at a penalty hearing and say, well, I examined this particular individual, and he's told all these conflicting stories. I don't know that he's really believable. And the fact that he's told all these conflicting stories leads me to think that he's not very remorseful. Well, that's not going to help Mr. Norcross at the penalty hearing, and I think counsel was wise to avoid putting Dr. Mechanic on the stand for that reason. The other indication, I think, by both Dr. Minchin and Dr. Mechanic was their diagnosis that Mr. Norcross was antisocial, and Dr. Minchin especially thought that that was not going to be helpful at a penalty hearing to have him give his expert psychological opinion that, well, Mr. Norcross is basically an antisocial person. That's not going to endear Mr. Norcross in any fashion to the jury, and I think that was a wise decision by counsel to forego that expert testimony. The other arguments about the statements that were made, those are addressed in the second argument. The trial judge did address all of those in the 2010 opinion, and we found some of them to be improper, but ultimately harmless error. And the state certainly agrees with that legal assessment. If there's any additional questions, I'll certainly attempt to answer those.
Opposing counsel made the statement that brain damage is a profoundly mitigating factor. What was the brain damage, or do you contend that there was no brain damage evidence?
Well, I don't know. Dr. Mack said brain damage, but I don't recall there being an MRI, a CAT scan, or even an X-ray that reveals any brain damage. Dr. Mechanic, the psychiatrist, said in his report that he did not see any reason for any further neurological testing to determine if there was organic brain damage. The other difficulty, I guess, with that is that what's the causal connection, even if he has some sort of brain damage, to this particular crime. It certainly didn't prevent him from carrying out the plan and enlisting a Confederate and eluding apprehension for over 3 years here. That people can have brain damage and they're able to function. I actually have some neurological deficits myself. I had a grade one concussion when I was a small child, and I have a knot on the side of my head. And the difficulty I have is that it affects apparently fine motor movements on the opposite side of your body. So I cannot wink my right eye, and I can't snap my right fingers. I can do it on the other side. And it's caused me no real difficulty in life. I'm able to adapt. And the fact that you have some brain damage, it's a matter of degree and a matter of what it is. The other component apparently is that it can affect speech, and I do have a speech impediment of sorts. I have trouble with aspirated sounds, but most people can understand what I say. And the third aspect of the neurological problem or brain damage that I have is it affects personality. And I don't know how it affects my personality, although some of my friends say my dog has more personality than I do, so maybe it does. But the point of all of this is that, these are matters of degree, and you can have problems. And people, when they sustain concussions, and my daughter had a concussion last year pole vaulting at school, those cause some damage to your brain, but it's a matter of what it is and how it manifests itself, and does it alter how you are able to function in life. And here there's no real indication that even if Mr. Norcross has any type of organic brain damage, that it's really affecting how he functions day to day or it has any connection to this particular crime. If there's any other questions, I'll try to answer those.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, good afternoon, and members of the court. Let me start at the end with Mr. Williams. If I was doing a penalty hearing with him, that brain damage that he just discussed, the public defender probably wouldn't care about it. I'd love to put his personality in front of the jury because it would show that he's a nice person. That's a mitigator. It might not have had any nexus to the crime for which he is going to be sentenced, which might be parking on the circle too long, for example, but it is a mitigator nonetheless.
Well, what exactly was the brain damage, and how does that function as a mitigator in this case?
Well, Justice Berger, first off, relative to the brain damage, which the state asserts does not exist, Dr. Mack did a number of tests, including the leading test to determine neurological dysfunction. ADHD, in and of itself, is brain damage. And the question is...
Let me rephrase my question. Other than finding that Norcross has various psychological disorders, was there any finding that he suffers from literally brain damage in terms of having a portion of his brain somehow rendered ineffective?
I apologize.
No, sorry.
Absolutely, and that's the distinction. The PTSD, which I have, is a psychological component and disorder under DSM-IV. And it may or may not involve brain damage, it may or may not be long-lasting. ADHD is an actual diagnosis which indicates that the individual has brain damage. Now, and accordingly, the follow-up to that is it affects the executive function of the brain. The executive function of the brain is, of course, directly correlated to the issues that the state would have you believe are aggravators, and as Ms. Aronson pointed out, can actually be used to rebut.
Just so I'm clear, you're saying that ADHD is evidence of brain damage, or is in fact brain damage?
Exceedingly well documented in the literature, yes, Justice Berger, and well recognized by any reasonable psychologist or psychiatrist who would testify in court. I think in the last four or five cases that might have come before the court, that may have been an issue. Obviously, it is no longer an unusual diagnosis per se. I also want to say a word about, before I move on to some other points that are worth time and rebuttal, this concept, I think sometimes people say antisocial so that the public defender's office runs into their bomb shelter. Antisocial personality, it sounds horrific, but in reality, particularly in the situation that Mr. Norcross would have been put in, and given his prison conduct records, and given his past history, is not nearly as disabling as it would sound. You might sit here and have somebody say, well, one of the aggravators was that he was an antisocial personality, or they wanted to suggest that this was a mitigator, and that's not true. Well, in reality, it is true. It is a mitigator because it explains, first off, there has to be something that kicks that off. And the self-reporting of the abuse as a child, the conduct disorder that occurred then that leads in to his adult behavior, there's all a nexus. And in fact, the trial counsel conceded at the Rule 61 that the records that they had or that we found would have explained a lot of things to the jury. And in fact, Linda Zervis testified that all the records that she saw from us and that the PD had that were never introduced, and she was never called as a witness. By the way, a lady who has three master's degrees and understands clearly the nexus between childhood abuse and personality disorder, which she also testified to, that the assessment that was done on Mr. Norcross when he was 15 showed a clear history of abuse, that he could adapt well to a structured prison environment. In other words, we wouldn't have had to bring in James Aiken to testify at the Rule 61, although he is one of the leading experts on this issue and in evaluating individuals, because Mr. Norcross essentially has a very limited, if non-existent, prison write-up record. So he does not present the danger that the state would have had this jury believe. The other part about the antisocial, and now we're 10 years down the road, 11 years down the road from this arrest and indictment, is that people grow out of or mature out of the antisocial because their life becomes adjusted. And I think I mentioned at the last hearing, Mr. Norcross spent, at our last argument, Mr. Norcross spent much of the Rule 61 sitting there doing origami. He's perfectly content. He is probably one of the least riskiest defendants that we could have in a courtroom. And this is not a commentary on the court's policy, but if he were to be sitting here in the courtroom, you would never notice it, unlike, obviously, the conduct or the repetitive filings you see from other individuals. I also want to point out that, and Ms. Aronson mentioned this earlier at the outset of her argument, that you have to look at an objective standard. And the last time we were here, I suggested to the court that remanding this case was pretty much going to get us nowhere, that we were going to get back basically what I would suggest we got back, which was an opinion that focused on three cases out of the United States Supreme Court that addressed federal analysis of circuit court cases that did not, despite the state's inclination, address any of the issues that the court directed the trial judge to reanalyze, and in fact used as an opportunity to basically say the trial counsel did a good job and he didn't like the fact that counsel on Rule 61 actually found information that had we presented it to a jury, Mr. Norcross would be serving life and we wouldn't be here today. And there's no doubt in counsel's mind as we sit here in this courtroom that had we tried this case, there is absolutely no way that Mr. Norcross would have even remotely gotten that unless we went into the Garden situation. And I think it's ironic that basically the same judge who was in Garden has basically thrown this back at you.
And maybe you can help me understand why you suggest that conclusion.
Well,
given the facts of this particular case, the jury that heard the guilt phase, obviously it's the jury that hears the penalty phase in normal conditions. Why would a jury, despite everything you would present in addition to what had been presented at the penalty phase, reach a different conclusion?
For one, Mr. Chief Justice, I think it's hard to believe that you remanded on seven cases and trial counsel essentially had blown all seven. I mean, independently, they had failed to meet the threshold standards of each of those seven. And
for the purposes of my question, I give you that premise.
Okay. And that's why
there was more investigation that could have been done, maybe even should have been done, and presented to the jury.
Right.
But the real question is, even if the jury had heard all this additional information, suggest to me why it would have made a difference in their vote.
Well, and I think it goes back to what Ms. Aronson said, is that at the outset, trial counsel said to the jury, we're going to paint him as a human being. We're going to show him as being different from other individuals. And then they never did it to the jury. They didn't explain to the jury why Adam Norcross was the way he was.
That's the adequacy argument again. Tell me why, if all of the painting of Mr. Norcross as a real human being had been on the canvas presented to the jury, why they would have come to a different recommendation, and why the trial judge would have given a life imprisonment sentence rather than the death penalty.
Well, and I'm going to have to parse this. First off, I think the jury, whenever they're given more information, that has two effects. One, adds to the mitigating side of the scale, and secondarily and simultaneously detracts from the aggravating side. And I'm going to incorporate into this the concept that the statement by the Marine is unacceptable. But even if it is acceptable, there's a compound explanation between psychological experts, witnesses, et cetera. And unlike the 10-2 vote that Mr. Norcross got, that jury, if we could go back in time, which I presume is what the Chief Justice is asking, that if we go back in time, no matter how you want to characterize the mother and the daughter, there is a synergy of emotion, compassion, empathy, and mercy, all recognized as the extreme mitigator by someone who is as harsh on the death penalty as many justices on the U.S. Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor, who said they are the key and leading elements of mitigation. And therefore, that jury would have had an entirely different set of evidence that it's balancing. And if you're adding to one side and taking away from the other, it leads to that conclusion that the jury has to find a different position and would have found a different position.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.